Emotions are central for being human. They're really at the core of human mind, human action, human thought. And today we're going to talk about the new approach to emotions, which is taken over the field, which has put emotions back in the center of development and the behavioral sciences where it belongs. The new approach is based on a biological perspective, and it assumes that emotions combine biology with culture, with experience. It puts emotion and intelligence together. So instead of our cultural conflict of emotion being the opposite of intelligence, they're together as two sides of the same coin. And it specifies particular emotion processes and organizations, we'll talk a lot about those today, which are really helpful when we're trying to analyze emotions in development or in activities. And also specifies what important variations are in emotion organization and emotion process, especially around emotional experiences such as trauma, and emotional experiences as defined by cultures. So the history is that emotions were kind of neglected in the behavioral sciences and in Western culture more generally. Rationalism has dominated with the invention of mathematics and formal logic over several centuries. People became so imbued with the beauty of math and logic that they assumed that that was really what was important about being human, and that emotion was something else that was kind of secondary or to be gotten rid of. So there's an enormous focus on rationalism, and with that an emphasis on the logic of the mind and a neglect of emotions. That really began to change a few decades ago, about three decades ago, when facial expressions became a topic of research, and people recognized that facial expressions are very objective, can be easily measured, and have a strong relationship with emotions. And from that, they came to bring emotions back in to the study of human behavior. These are two facial expressions, obviously defining the more positive, more negative emotions. Facial expressions are species-specific characteristics. They're subject to cultural influence, but they're common across human beings in many ways. Indeed, when people looked at facial expressions, they found that they could identify a set of them which were pretty common across people and across cultures. Even blind children show them, who've never seen faces, people in very different places, very different cultures, you know, New York City or Tibet or a South American village show the same basic facial expressions, especially for anger, fear, sadness, shame. Disgust and shame are pretty similar. Happiness and surprise for that list of emotions. So Paul Ekman and Cal Izard were really important in making this work scientific and in establishing these facts, and it changed the way people think about emotions. Notice this little note down here. I often put things in parentheses or brackets as kind of notes. Love isn't in this list. We'll come back to that. So, love is, I think, does have facial expressions associated with it. A number of people are now saying the problem with love is that it requires two faces. The biases of our field are not only towards rationalism, but also towards individualism. If you only look at one face, then you can't see two faces in love. And eye-to-eye contact is probably the most common... I don't know why my mouse is suddenly switched on me. There we go. Is it going to show what it's supposed to? Here we go. Love requires two faces. Because eye-to-eye contact is one of the most important characteristics of the facial expressions for love. I hope you enjoy those dancers. They're my artistic creation. The new approach that was built on this bringing emotion back with the help of the research on facial expressions is called the functional approach to emotions. It's functional in the sense that it says that emotions are a part of ordinary functioning. They're not just extra things that we want to get rid of. In that it says that emotions have a function. They have a purpose, a goal. They do something for human beings and other animals that have them. They're also biologically based and culturally shaped, as we've said before. In fact, this approach grows right out of Darwin. It's an irony that over 100 years ago, Darwin wrote a book on emotions, which had only a little bit of influence until about 30 years ago. And then all of a sudden, with Darwin long dead, it helped start a new approach to emotions. The most important people in this field are probably Nico Frida, Arnold Lazarus, Joe Campos, and Phil Shaver. You'll read something by Frida, who's really probably the primary person starting this approach. He's a Dutch psychologist. So what emotion involves, according to this approach, is change. That the organization of what we do changes as a function of an evaluation that we have of what's happening to us. So we get an action tendency that changes how we act and how we think, and of course how we feel. Facial expressions are a good way of illustrating this. I'm just kind of ordinary in my state, and then something happens to me, like somebody gives me a present of a book that I've been wanting for my whole life and haven't been able to find, and suddenly I'm happy, and my face changes into a happy face. Along with that, a lot of other things about my behavior change too. It gets reorganized. For example, when you're happy, at least moderately happy, you can remember a lot of things better. On the other hand, when something terrible happens, and something you can't do anything about, then you switch from being neutral to being sad or even depressed. And you have a sad facial expression, and you tend to withdraw and have a kind of gloomy view of the world. So, in general, emotions change who we are. This is a broad organizing or biasing or constraining effect. People use all three of those words. Each emotion has its own organizing pattern, which we are trying to describe in the field in terms of action scripts, in terms of facial expressions, in terms of bodily patterns. Those action patterns are, each of them, adaptive in some way. They help us relate better to the world in a general way, function better in the world. We'll try to analyze these kinds of action tendencies in some videotapes in class. I'm going to do a kind of a demonstration of a metaphor for how emotions organize behavior. For some people, it's kind of obvious that emotions organize behavior. For other people, we've gotten so caught up in the cultural view that emotions are epiphenomena, extra things that don't really have any function, that it takes a little bit of effort to start thinking this way about how emotion is central and emotion is so closely tied to cognition. If you think about emotion as a magnet, you've got a series of iron particles that are moving through space. That's your actions, your characteristics, what you're doing and thinking and feeling. And the magnet comes in, like suddenly you're happy, and that shapes the way those activities or those iron particles are moving, so that they're now attracted to the magnet, so they form a certain kind of a pattern. And over time, this emotion dissipates. your activities stop having that organization. And then, again, the same emotion happens and a similar kind of organization occurs. So the kind of happy pattern emerges over and over and over, especially if you're in a life situation that lets you be happy a lot. Over time, it actually can have a lasting impact on you. I think the suggested readings, there's an article by Malatesta in which she shows that people develop a kind of dominant one or two facial expressions that they show a lot and that they can act out easily, and their faces actually start taking on the shape of the facial expression over time. It's often attributed to Abe Lincoln, the quote that you're not responsible for what your face looks like until you're 40. By then, your kind of personality has shaped your face, and so you become responsible for what your face looks like. So if you're a happy person, then a smile becomes kind of imprinted in your wrinkles, in the shape of your face. If you're a grumpy person, then that becomes dominant. I remember especially from Malatesta's slides, there's one woman from New York City, fitting the stereotype for New York City, who no matter what she tried to show, as she was asked to show a series of facial expressions, always looked contemptuous. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that Lincoln was talking about, the lasting effect of emotions on our faces and on our activities as well. So emotions combine biology, culture, experience in the same piece. They all work together, and emotion and intelligence work together. So the kind of dichotomies that we have, is it nature, is it nurture, is it emotion, is it intelligence, you have to get beyond those to understand how emotions work. Brain is really centrally involved in emotions, and the classical part of the brain that we say involves emotions is the limbic system. As it turns out, that also is as powerfully involved in cognitive effects. Memory is everywhere in the limbic system, for example. So the limbic system is emotion and cognition together, really. It's not just emotion. It's in the midbrain here. Below the cortex that we usually associate with intelligence, but of course it turns out that the limbic system is really closely tied with the cortex, and especially with the prefrontal cortex, which is often taken as the kind of place that rationality is in overly simple views of the mind. So you've got the very rational place being very emotional, and you've got the very emotional place being very cognitive, and in brain structure as well as in what we do, cognition and emotion are together. So you've got culture and experience sharply affecting how we feel and how we think and how we act all together. There's a really famous, important psychologist named Donald Hebb from Canada. He died a few years ago, but he established better than anyone else the argument that emotion and intelligence go together. He also did a lot of great neuroscience and even has a neural circuit named after him. He's the only psychologist I know of with a neural circuit named after him, Hebbian circuits. He demonstrated that emotionality actually increases with intelligence across species. So dogs are much more emotional than rats. Rhesus monkeys are much more emotional than dogs. Chimpanzees are more emotional than rhesus monkeys. And guess who's the most emotional of all, according to him? Human beings. Because the more intelligent you are, the more differentiated your emotions become. The more differentiated your cognitions become. You can get upset about all kinds of things that chimpanzees can't get upset about. Or you can be joyful or in awe of things that chimpanzees can't have those feelings about. So I'll illustrate this with some of his examples and some other things from more recent research. Kim Sheridan pointed out this quote to describe the mind as not full of knowledgeful feeling and feelingful knowledge. Kind of demonstrates this point that brain and cognition, brain and intelligence, I mean emotion and intelligence go together. So one of Hebb's main demonstrations was what he called irrational fear, irrational aggression, which involved the demonstration that less intelligent animals don't show much irrational fear. He worked a lot with chimpanzees and also dogs and monkeys and showed that they have a lot of irrational fear. And then went on to talk about human beings. One of his kind of cute demonstrations was a chimpanzee had a regular caregiver who came in and took care of him every day. And the caregiver typically came in, put on a particular kind of clothes, walked in to deal with the chimpanzee. One day he was in a hurry. He walks into laboratory, and the chimp starts out with this kind of a facial expression, kind of regular chimp facial expression, curious, maybe a little activated because his caregiver just came in. And instead of his wearing his usual lab clothes, he was wearing something else. And the chimp got very upset, ran away from him and screamed, threatened him. This is the same thing happened with me. I raised a rhesus monkey in graduate school. I don't recommend it unless you're really into monkeys. It was interesting and I learned a lot and I loved her and she loved me, but it was hard. Anyway, one of the things that happened one day is this was back when I was a young man and the hairstyles were long. And I had a kind of an afro, frizzy hair sticking out. I went to the wrong barber. The barber decided I was going to have a crew cut. So I got all my hair cut off, which isn't what I wanted, but it's what happened. I went home, walked into the apartment, and my monkey screamed and ran away and wouldn't let me touch her. I looked weird to her, and that was enough to make her afraid of me. Well, human beings have a whole lot of these kinds of irrational fears. We act like that, like the chimpanzee, showing fear and threat. For a whole lot of things. In fact, we're the only species that is afraid of and angry about ideas. Okay, we can kill somebody because they're a Marxist, or because they have beliefs about abortion, or about the kind of clothes you wear that are very different from ours. And there are many, many instances of this kind of wars being fought over ideas, people being murdered and tortured over ideas. Other species don't do that. So if you need some demonstration that human beings are irrational emotionally, if you're skeptical about this argument that we're the most emotional species, look at our wars, look at our cultural conflicts, I think it then becomes very hard to doubt Hebb's argument. We have a long history of emotionality over all kinds of bizarre things. We love ideas, we hate ideas, and we act in terms of those emotions when we're faced with the ideas. Now, besides the negative emotions, there are also more positive ones. Humor is maybe a prime example. There hasn't been nearly as much work on humor as there has been on fear and anxiety, but there is a fair amount. One of the things that's interesting is that chimpanzees tell jokes. They don't literally tell them. They play jokes. They have a kind of slapstick humor. So they... the two jokes that I've experienced with chimps, visiting them in chimpanzee colonies, are both practical jokes. One is they see you coming, this vulnerable human being who they don't know. They sneak over to the water fountain, they get a mouthful of water, and then they sit there quietly until you come up, and when you get close, they squirt you. And they think it's hilarious that you jump back and act all startled and everything. Another one that they do is a little grosser. They'll throw feces at you, and human beings don't like that, and they think it's really hilarious the way human beings react. They literally laugh. They also laugh to tickling. If some of you have heard of Washo, the talking chimp, the first one with sign language, one of her first sentences was "more tickle." Chimpanzees show humor. Some other apes, a little bit, but the best demonstration is with chimpanzees and bonobos, another kind of chimpanzee. of course, human beings have very extensive humor. In many cultures, it's really elaborated. You can even spend your whole life being a comedian and making a lot of money, or not making so much money, depending on how successful you are. Another example of this kind of a humor effect is teasing. We tease out of affection and out of kind of spite. And there's a lot of laughing around teasing. It turns out chimpanzees and dolphins also tease. Chimpanzees are the most intelligent human relative, chimpanzees and bonobos, and among non-primates, the most intelligent are some species of dolphins, as far as we know right now. An important thing to remember about laughter, though, and smiling, is that a lot of times it doesn't involve jokes or humor. There are a lot of reasons for smiling. In most primate interactions, like with chimpanzees or with rhesus monkeys, you have a smile is a way of saying, I'm not a threat, I want to be your friend. When I raised my rhesus monkey from birth, she rather rapidly developed a whole series of facial expressions that I didn't teach her, of course. They were rhesus monkey facial expressions. And one of them was that if I stared at her, she would start going like this. Staring is a threat gesture for rhesus monkeys. I had to learn not to stare at her. For human beings, it can be a threat gesture, but it's not always. It can also be, for example, a sign of love and eye-to-eye contact. But for rhesus monkeys, it's pretty threatening. And she would do this smile all the time. And it wasn't because she was happy. It was saying, back off. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just your child, and I'm a friend. In many human situations, some research has shown that even laughter does not usually involve jokes or funny activities. If you're in a group, there's a whole lot of laughter that has other kinds of social functions. It seems to have something to do with social communication, with social bonding, with social connection, things that we share, and occasionally it involves humor. Now, what about sex? Another emotion that is sometimes considered positive, or at least an emotional activity. It turns out that sexuality free of reproduction is very closely tied to intelligence. As mammals get more and more intelligent, their sexual behavior becomes less tied to periods when they can get pregnant. In the only species that we know where sexual activity is pretty much independent of pregnancy are, again, human beings and dolphins, two of the most intelligent species. But for chimpanzees, there's some sexual activity when you can't get pregnant. For dogs, there's a little bit of sexual activity when you can't get pregnant. For rats, there's hardly anything. Sexuality is also tied to intelligence, like kind of differentiated emotions in general. I hope these examples give a convincing argument. They certainly represent some of the most important evidence that emotion and intelligence go together, that the smarter you are, the more differentiated your emotions are. And the more different kinds of emotions you have, the more different kinds of things you can react to emotionally. With all of these different emotions that human beings have, we have to figure out how to talk about them. We have to figure out how they hang together, how they're organized. And the new research on emotions has built up a set of different ways of talking about emotional organization. I'm going to focus on two main ones today, the idea of dimensions of emotions and the idea of families of emotions in a hierarchy. Two other concepts that are we'll just barely touch on today, but you'll read about and we'll have in other parts of the course, the idea that emotions follow scripts, kind of activity scripts, a prescribed set of activities for a particular emotion, and that there's a certain kind of process, a certain way we go through processing what is happening to us that leads to emotional reactions. So for dimensions, there are several dimensions that are common across people, across cultures, that organize emotions. But the most important one is the positive-negative evaluation dimension, sometimes called approach avoidance, sometimes called acceptance rejection. In general, it's is this good for me or is it bad for me? Or is it good for my family or bad for my family? Is it good for my friend or bad for my friend? It's generally around me and the people and things that are important to me. And that is just, it's the most important dimension in human behavior by most criteria. It was discovered originally 120 years ago in the first experimental psychology laboratory through introspective methods by Wilhelm Wundt and his colleagues in Germany. It was rediscovered by statistical techniques called factor analysis when they were invented. It's been rediscovered again in content analysis. Of various kinds. It's just pervasive and very powerful. It often carries as much as 50% of the variability in human activities. Things like ratings of words or of people. An important question is, what are the brain bases of this dimension and of the other central dimensions in emotional organization? This positive-negative dimension in literature and popular culture all the time. Here's a cartoon from Peanuts, Charles Schulz cartoon strip, showing emotionality and, in particular, emotional splitting. Lucy says, "This, Linus, is a picture of the human heart. One side is filled with hate and the other side is filled with love. These are the two forces which are constantly at war with each other." And Linus says, "I think I know just what you mean. I can feel them fighting. In fact, we split the world into love and hate, good and bad, frequently. You can see it in our literature. You can see it in our popular movies. In the Bible, we have God and Satan. In Star Wars, we have Darth Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Virtually every myth, there's good and evil. When they get interesting, sometimes evil turns into good or good turns into evil, the way Darth Vader eventually saves the good guys in Star Wars. But it's a basic dimension in virtually everything human. And it turns out there's a very nice, simple brain correlate for it, just discovered in the last 10 years. When you look at brain activity, you measure it electrically or magnetically, you find that there are different patterns of activation in different parts of the brain. It turns out that for most people, this evaluation dimension is distinctly reflected in the left and right prefrontal parts of the cortex in activity patterns. So when you have left activation here, you're in a more positive mood. When you have right activation here, you're in a more negative mood. I'll show you what this means. Here we've got the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. With positive emotion, we have this kind of an activation in the left hemisphere more than in the right hemisphere. This is the brain wave pattern. And when you have a negative emotion, you get the opposite with more activation in the right hemisphere than in the left hemisphere. This is such a powerful general effect, it's now being used to evaluate emotional state frequently in research. One of the early studies using this with children looked at inhibited versus non-inhibited or outgoing children. So inhibited children are shyer, introverted. Uninhibited children are more outgoing. It turns out that inhibited children are actually more emotional in many ways than uninhibited children, contrary to the stereotypes. We'll talk about that in class when we go through some videotapes of inhibited and uninhibited children. But for this brain activity measure, here are the basic results from a study by Davidson et al. Harvard graduates are really involved in this field. Richie Davidson graduated from the psychology department, got his PhD there. Nathan Fox graduated from human development and psychology, got his doctorate here. And they are two of the main people who've shown this research with children. So you see here, inhibited children show a lot more activity in the right hemisphere, just in ordinary quiet alert state. They're not acting upset right now, but they're showing this negative emotionality, whereas outgoing children are showing much more positive emotionality, as evidenced by activity in the left hemisphere. There are lots of studies using this now. As I mentioned, one of the cuter ones was looking at depressed adolescent girls, and they found that one of the ways you could get them into a better mood, as measured by brain activity, was to play rock music. Rock music as defined by middle-aged researchers rather than by younger people. My 21-year-old son, who plays in a band, tells me that rock has a very specific meaning. It doesn't mean all popular music except for hip-hop, which is the way I use it and the way these researchers used it. So what are the dimensions of emotional organization besides this positive-negative evaluation? There are two that come up over and over again. Again, starting with this research in Germany at the founding of experimental psychology 120 years ago, continuing to today. The second dimension is generally activation or arousal. How jacked up are you? How awake? How alert? And the third one is a relational or self-other dimension. It's got this one, there are a lot of different names for it, but they all boil down to something about self and other in relationship to each other. And this one seems to differ a great deal across cultures at this point from early research. All of them show some differences across cultures, but a lot of cultural differences seem really to involve this self-other relational dimension in a central way. There's one of the suggested readings about that. It's Kitayama and Marcus, if you want to look at it. So here are the dimensions. I'm representing them in three-dimensional space. A routine way of doing it. People do it a lot this way. You have evaluation, and then you have arousal from low to high, and then you have self-other. And you can take any emotion for a given culture and place it in this this three-dimensional space. So if you take anger, for example, anger is sometimes positive, sometimes negative. In American culture, we think of it as negative, but when you actually look at behavior, it has some really positive functions, getting people to stop bugging you, getting things to happen. If we didn't have anger, we wouldn't have social change, for example. So you have... it's both positive and negative, so it's in the middle in the positive-negative dimension. It's high on arousal, and it's focused on the other. One of the things emotions do a lot of times is have a focus on the self or a focus on the other. For anger, you know, I'm the one that's angry, but you're the one that did it. Why did you do that to me? And actually, one of the biases in the anger emotion is towards blaming somebody, finding who caused this problem and getting rid of them or getting them out of the way. Bunch of emotions can be done this way. Shame is another one. Shame is a particularly interesting one because America, American culture, English language culture more broadly, is impoverished in our words and differentiation of shame, whereas many cultures, especially Eastern cultures like China and Japan, have exquisitely differentiated concepts of shame. But in general, shame is seen as negative, more negative in the U.S. than in China, but still negative. High in arousal and focused on the self, unlike anger. I'm the one who did something shameful, right? I'm the one to blame, not you. And this hiding is the main expressive gesture for shame. Hiding your face, trying to turn away, get away, escape. To highlight cultural differences, it's interesting to look at shame and pride. In the U.S., we think that being proud is the opposite of being ashamed, at least in the dominant English language culture in the U.S. But in China, pride is a very negative emotion. Shame is more positive than pride in many ways. Oversimplifying a little bit, of course, there are different kinds of pride and different kinds of shame. But in general, the opposite of shame in my Chinese colleagues tell me is respect for Chinese, whereas in the U.S. people tend to say pride or proud. So that gives you an idea about the three dimensions and how you can take particular emotion and locate it in this organization for emotion space in terms of three dimensions. The second dimension you'll remember is activation or arousal. We've already talked about brain bases of the first dimension. For the second dimension, there's even more evidence of brain bases. There's a whole piece of the brain that's specifically devoted to controlling arousal. It's called the reticular activating system. Activate is like arouse. If you look at the brain, this is the cortex, the midbrain, the brain stem. The reticular activating system is in the brain stem, and it's capped by the thalamus. They work together to do the main regulation of activation or arousal. You can look at it from the bottom of the brain, and there it's in this region. Now, EEG, or electroencephalogram, or magnetoencephalogram, brain waves measured electrically or magnetically, can be used to look at brain functioning during different states of arousal. And there's a very powerful relationship. You can tell how aroused somebody is by looking at their brain activity. Also produces some interesting surprises about sleep. So you can also look at heart rate, blood pressure, a lot of things. With arousal, the body changes dramatically. But there's a lot of interesting research in particular on EEG and how it relates to arousal. If you have arousal going up the slide here, very awake, you have mostly alpha and beta activity in the electroencephalogram. That means relatively rapid activity. If you look at stage one sleep, that's just when you're falling asleep, and also you go through a cycle in sleep. Your sleep goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and then comes up to more closer to awake, and then deeper and deeper and deeper, and then up closer to awake. Another one of these biological cycles that are so common. So in stage one sleep, which you start with and then you return to, you have theta activity, which is much slower frequencies of brain waves. And in stage 4 sleep, I'm skipping the ones in the middle, the deepest sleep, you get very high waves and very slow waves. In this kind of sleep, which human beings show dramatically, especially early in a night's sleep, some species don't show this kind of deep sleep. It's very hard to wake people up, actually. You're really out of it. If you have to wake up for some reason, it's a major struggle. When people do things like sleepwalking and they don't remember anything about it, they're usually in this very deep sleep. Arousal occurs in sleep as well as awake. Normally we think of when you're asleep, you're not aroused. But I mentioned that there's a cycle of ups and downs in sleep. When we dream, we're actually aroused while we're asleep. The field of dream work, of our understanding of dreams, dream research, has just blossomed since this was discovered several decades ago. We know an enormous amount now about dreams because we can actually study people while they're asleep, know when they're dreaming, look at what happens to them, what they do when they're dreaming, and wake them up and ask them what they were experiencing. So this is a kind of typical activity during what's called rapid eye movement sleep, which is when you're dreaming. Much of it is alpha and beta activity, just like when you're awake. It's called rapid eye movement sleep because the eyes actually flicker a lot. You have a whole lot of quick movements in the eyes when you're asleep. Mostly when you're in REM sleep, dreaming sleep, your body shuts down. Your muscles and your perceptual system shut down. So you literally can't move your arms or move your legs. If you think of a vivid dream you've had, it makes sense that you wouldn't be able to move, because if you're dreaming that you're walking up the stairs, well, you don't actually want to get up and out of bed and start walking up the stairs while you're asleep. So your body shuts down your muscles, and it turns out it shuts down most of your primary perceptual systems, as far as more recent research indicates. Some of the findings that we have about dreams relate very nicely to Freud's work on what unconscious functioning is and how that plays out in dreams. Early on in the research on dreams, some people were thinking that Freud's ideas weren't holding up, but as more and more research has been done, including research on what the brain is doing during rapid eye movement sleep, it turns out that Freud's ideas are nicely supported by the brain evidence. Remember, the limbic system is central in emotions, often called the emotion center. It turns out that during rapid eye movement sleep, the limbic system is very active. Well, Freud said that dreams had a lot to do with emotions. I mentioned to you already that the motor system is shut down. Also, the primary visual system isn't active in the brain. So your eyes aren't taking in information, even though they're moving around wildly. Most of the motor system is shut down, but for some reason the eye muscles are not shut down. Maybe that's that whoever designed the system wanted us to be able to study it through assessing rapid eye movements. I have no idea why, but it's handy for us. It turns out the prefrontal cortex also shuts down. Now, that has a lot to do with complicated higher cognitive processing, as we talked about briefly before. So again, that fits with Freud's argument that dreams are mostly irrational, because a lot of the higher processes that are assumed to have to do with rationality seem to require contributions from the prefrontal cortex. There's an interesting new evidence now. Recently, people are trying to see how brain activity during REM sleep relates to brain activity while you're awake. The best research has been done with animals. Matthew Wilson at MIT did a nice study with rats where the the patterns that you see in brain activity during the day in a given rat show up in that rat during REM again that night. So different activities over different days correlate with different REM patterns at night across days and across rats. So it looks like one of the things that may be going on in dreams is some kind of reliving, maybe editing your experience to maybe put it into memory where it's appropriate. At least that's a hypothesis that's consistent with this this indication that our dreams really do in part rework what we did that day. I should tell you, this is Anna and Sigmund Freud. Sigmund is, of course, the founder of psychoanalysis, but Anna, his daughter, was his kind of primary student in a lot of ways. There are many people very strongly influenced by Freud, but she really built a whole lot of the theory with him, especially in the later years, and especially around higher functions, like what are called ego functions. And this is a drawing of the Freudian model of the mind, which we put together a few years ago. The unconscious is under the water. The ego is partly above the water, partly under the water. The superego is mostly under the water, just a tiny bit above the water. And then there's this other person across the water, also having the conscious mind kind of showing the unconscious hidden under the water. That wasn't a bad first pass for describing how the mind works emotionally and socially. You'll remember from before we talked about how we have agencies in the mind, like our mother and our father and our best friend or our spouse. And Freud hypothesized these particular agencies, and we don't think about it that way exactly anymore. But the broad idea is that there's conscious and unconscious functioning, and that there are agencies that are interacting with each other to produce who we are and how we act and how we feel. Those ideas have really held up very well, as have Freud's ideas on dreams. So, in general, if we look at the dimensions, come back to them, talk about brain functioning, we have, for the evaluation dimension of emotions, we have the activation pattern that the left hemisphere goes with more positive emotions, right hemisphere with more negative emotions in most people. The brain is organized differently in different people, so in some people it reverses. But in most people it fits that pattern. For activation or arousal, we have these evidence of the reticular activating system controlling arousal, of EEG frequency, heart rate, many other bodily functions changing very systematically with variations in arousal. Now there's the third one, the relational or self-other one. We have a lot, we know a lot about that in terms of cultural differences, in terms of cognition-emotion relations in what people do. We know nothing about it in terms of brain functioning. It's a very important dimension of emotions, and we clearly need to figure out how it relates to brain functioning. It hasn't been done. Also, most of this stuff has not been looked at developmentally very much. There hasn't been much systematic research on how these dimensions relate to development. We've been pursuing with several colleagues how the evaluation dimension relates to development. I'll talk about some of that now. We'll talk about if more as the course progresses. But it's amazing how long we've known about evaluation as the key dimension to human emotions, and how little work there's been on how that relates to development. Okay, in the organization of emotions, the dimension of evaluation is really central. And one of the things that it is involved with is what we call the fundamental attribution error. It is that a healthy person generally thinks of themselves as good, as positive, and as negative things mostly involving other people. Another version of that is that when something good happens to me, I'm proud and responsible that I'm responsible for this wonderful thing that happened. But when something bad happens to me, somebody else did it, some other event did it. So in general, there's a fundamental attribution error that I'm good and the bad is out there, not my responsibility. When you look at the facts judged by somebody else, this is clearly a bias. People see themselves as in much better shape than they actually are. But it turns out that's a sign of mental health. When you're depressed or when you've been horrendously traumatized, you don't show this bias. But normally, if you're functioning pretty well, you do. So it's a really fundamental attribution error. It's something that's a basic part of being a healthy human being. A key research question is, how does this develop? How does this kind of positive bias develop? And more generally, how does evaluation develop in children and adolescents? We've studied this with a couple of techniques. Self and relationships is the one I'm going to talk about today. With this interview, we can assess a lot of things about the person. We can assess their cognitive complexity. We can assess their specific relationships. We can assess their feelings about themselves in important relationships and how they organize some of those feelings. We also can look at it with high support and low support assessments, optimal and functional level. And we've used it now in a number of cultures, mainly in the Far East and in North America. And one of the things we can use it for is to look at this emotional bias about evaluation. This is a sample of a girl from Korea, from a study in Seoul by Bruce Kennedy. What this girl did was to first describe what she was like in her important relationships. What was she like with her best friend, with her father, with her mother, with another friend, with a romantic friend, in school, with a sibling, and with the real me. When Susan Harder first suggested this real me category, some people thought that kids might not understand it, but we've found that even six-year-olds have no difficulty understanding, at least giving answers to, what is the real me like. They describe what they're like with each of these roles or relationships. They write it down, or the interviewer writes it down for them on a little piece of paper with glue on the back, you know, post-it paper. And then they group it in this diagram and they relate them to each other. The most important ones go in the middle, the least important ones on the outside. And every category that they or description that they make is evaluated in terms of its positive or negative evaluation or valence. They come up with these wonderfully complex diagrams. Virtually every child and adolescent we've seen loves to do this. They love to have a sensitive adult talking with them about who they are and their important relationships, what they're like, what they feel about it. For this Korean girl, she describes the real me as cheerful, and that's real important. She describes with her romantic friends, she's unpretentious, and that's important. She is shy in the real me, that's important. It's quite common in the Asian adolescents to describe themselves as shy and to have that be positive. In the U.S., it's usually not positive. She also describes herself as awkward with her romantic friend, as troublesome with her sibling, as bossy with her sibling, as having a dislike relationship with her father. And these are all negative and all not important. So this emotional bias really shows up. If I get rid of the words and just show you the positive and negative, you can see it very clearly in these diagrams that the important stuff is almost all positive and the negative stuff is all less important or least important. This is pervasive. We see it in virtually every child and adolescent and adult that we interview with this technique, in every culture. Some people thought that this would not show up in the Eastern cultures. That wasn't the case. So if you plot this for Korean study, you see the positive things are most important. Not very many of the positive ones are least important. The negative things are least important. Not very many of them are most important. And if you plot this across the cultures that we've studied, Korea, mainland China, U.S., Taiwan too, though it's not on the graph, you see the curves are all the same. They all show this positive bias. Around 80% of the most important is positive, 70 to 85, and many fewer, like 20 to 30%, are of them are least important. So this is an example of the fundamental attribution error in development, and we find it in 6 or 7 year olds, and we find it in 25 year olds. The major developmental change in this is that the little kids, being in a good mood with a supportive interviewer, see everything as positive, and we really have to insist that they describe some negative things in order to get them. So we expressly say, now everybody has some negative things about themselves, some things they don't like so much. Could you tell us about some of those? Be sure to include those. Also, with age, we're more likely to admit that a few things that are negative or ambivalent are important. So there's actually a positive correlation between saying that negative things are important and how old you are. At 15 or 20, you start to have most people admitting one or two things that are negative and important. Whereas at 8 or 10, nothing that's negative is important. Now, when you're in a violent role relationship, an abusive one, and you're the victim, this changes. The one case where we've been able to find, through a number of studies now, find a reversal of this fundamental attribution error in self, in relationships, is where you, somebody is a victim of horrendous abuse over a long time in childhood. When that happens, sometimes you get a pervasive negative bias instead of a positive one. So you have people saying, especially for sexual abuse, that they are basically bad, and that that's important. Here's one of the most sad, depressing cases that we have. Jessie, she's 14. She started having severe sexual and physical abuse and neglect at age 5. There were multiple people abusing her, family members and close friends of the family. What does she say? She says that everything about her that's important is negative, and everything about her that's positive is not important. It's very sad. Just to fill it in a little bit for you, she says she is mean and loud and hostile and uncooperative and angry and ugly and stupid and fat and bad. Those are all important. She's also fun, creative, happy, energetic, flirtatious, funny, caring, affectionate, but those aren't very important. It's a really horrendous outcome of abuse. This is another case from this study with Rosemary Calverly and Gil Nomet at one of the local hospitals. Jennifer was sexually abused by her stepfather many times over several years. She shows a similar pattern, but she has a lot more positives, and she does see some of the positives as important. She still, though, shows the negatives as being all important. So she sees herself in a much more negative light. It turns out in this research that, of course, most of these girls are depressed some of the time. There's a hypothesis in the literature that depression goes with a kind of negative core self. What we found in our sample is that the depressed girls who were not abused did not show this. Even though they were depressed, they still had the fundamental attribution error of seeing themselves as mostly positive terms. Important things were positive. We're hypothesizing at this point that depression has to be separated into different categories, that a lot of the research is confounding depression with abuse, and it's the abuse that's creating the evidence for the strong negative core self, not the depression. The abuse creates depression, but if you have depression that's not connected to abuse, you don't have the strong negative core self. You're just depressed. You still see yourself as mostly good, but life is kind of hard. A group of phenomena we're going to talk about concerning emotional organization is variation across culture. This is a beautiful demonstration of how biology and culture go together, because emotion words, emotion categories show powerful commonalities across cultures. As I was describing with the facial expressions before, there are many similarities, much more than people used to think. But they also show really big differences. So you've got the biology kind of shaping towards a certain kind of an emotional organization, but you've got culture also shaping and moving that organization in one direction or another, just like the magnet moving the iron files. In emotions in general, if you look at emotion words, emotion concepts, or emotion faces, you find that they fall into families, broad families, where there's a family resemblance between similar words. In the research that was done on this, I'm going to focus on the U.S. and China. It's also been done in some other countries with various methods. In this work, it starts with a native dictionary, like the main dictionary used for in Beijing, or the main dictionary used in Denver. Then you pick out words that name emotions, and you have people decide which of these many words that you pick out of the dictionary actually name emotions well, and then you have them group those words into things that go together, and you take the way they group them and you do something called hierarchical cluster analysis, and that shows you which words are more similar and which words are more different. And when you do that for the United States, the first thing for every country, the first thing that hits you for emotion words in general is negative, positive, that evaluation dimension. It falls into two groups there on that dimension. But then at the basic level, sort of the, it's called basic because it's prototypic. There's a lot of research showing that human concepts are usually based on prototypes, kind of a best instance. In prototypes, there's a basic level, sort of what's the kind of level that people fall back on automatically if they don't have to do something more specialized. For emotions, in the U.S. and in England, you have happiness, love, fear, sadness, and anger for English words as your basic families. Now, under those families, there are a number of subfamilies, like fondness and infatuation under love, and worry and horror under fear. And there are many words in for each of the subfamilies. Those are called subordinate categories. So in general, you'll notice that these five basic words, five basic families of words, fit well with the facial expressions we talked about before. They were all in the facial expression list except for love, which should have been in the list. This was exciting when Shaver and his colleagues found this set of findings and showed that it applied in something like this turned up in Italy too, for example. But then they went to China and they did the same thing, starting with the Mandarin dictionary, they found something very similar and very different. Sure enough, it's positive, negative for the superordinate dimension. And sure enough, happiness, love, fear, sadness, and anger show up again as families. But there's some big changes marked in red here. Shame is a whole family of emotion words in Chinese. We found over 150 words when we tried to just interview people and get a list of Chinese shame words. In English, it's just a little tiny family under sadness. But in Chinese, it's a whole big, well-articulated family. And the other big difference is that love is negative. That doesn't mean it's always negative, but it means sort of modally it's negative, more negative than positive. They actually call it sad love. They argue that the reason for this is, well, you can see it in the family, sorrowful love, unrequited love. Love is kind of messy. It kind of interferes with family relationships and needs. Marriages have often been arranged. If you love somebody else, then the one person that you're marrying, just to give a concrete example, then you're going to have sorrowful love or dangerous love. If you love somebody and they don't love you back, you have unrequited love. If you go back to romantic literature and music from the 19th century, there's a whole lot of stuff about unrequited love, even in European culture. So you see these emotions are the same across cultures, and they're different across cultures. It's not one or the other. It's both at the same time. In children's early words, people, again, Shaver and his colleagues, but also some other people, have looked at early words and what emotion categories showed up in them. The same words show up in the U.S. and Britain, toddlers' words, 2 and 3 year olds, and in Chinese children in Beijing. So in the U.S. and Britain, you have anger, sadness, fear, love, happiness, also good, bad, nice, mean. In China, you have anger, sadness, fear, shame, love, and happiness. No shame in the U.S. or Britain. Lots of shame in the Chinese children. This is affecting the development from an early age, this kind of cultural focus on shame versus cultural neglect of shame. The Chinese often say that Americans are shameless. And this research shows that literally we're shameless and that we don't even have many words for it. The best guess at this point is that most cultures in the world have shame as a very well-articulated category, and English language cultures are unusual, and some other Western language cultures, in having shame be a diminished category instead of a whole family by itself. So we actually went, Vian Kin Wang, Jean Lee, and I, to look at shame words in Chinese. We had originally about 150 words. We removed some because they seemed too specific to a particular culture or person. We got down to 144. Then we had those rated for how much they actually captured the emotions by a group of native Chinese, and they picked 83 words that were good shame words. We have 7 or something in English. Then we had another group of Chinese adults sort those in the same way it was done in the previous research, and they produced a hierarchy of shame families. I think this is very informative. I'll show you this hierarchy. Because we English speakers, being so impoverished about shame, really have a lot to learn from the Chinese about what shame means. So, interesting. The superordinate dimension is not positive-negative evaluation in this case. Of course, positive-negative evaluation are there, but more important, carrying more of the variation, is the self-other dimension, that third dimension of emotional organization. 6 families were differentiated out by the cluster analysis. embarrassment, that sounds like something we might know about in English. Shamelessness, well, you can find it in Old English literature, but you don't hear much about it today, at least at Harvard. Disgrace, guilt. It's not true, there is no guilt concept in Chinese. They have lots of words for guilt. Face already lost. I love that one. That's a concept that Americans generally don't have. Fear of losing face. If we look at more specific subfamilies, it gets maybe even more interesting. Condemning for lack of shame, casting disgusted voice. Love that one. Shame into rage. That's an interesting one. Think about it. I think you'll be able to think of situations where somebody is embarrassed or ashamed and they get mad. That's true in China too, and they have a whole bunch of words for it. Shy and blushing, self-inferior, hushing up scandal, lots of words differentiating out what shame is about in self and in others. Shame is a prominent human emotion, an important human emotion, and in some cultures, maybe most, it's a very well differentiated family of emotions, concepts, and activities. To finish up, I'm just going to mention the process of emotion generation that's in the readings, and we can talk about it in class or in sections if you want to elaborate on it. It's a kind of an information processing analysis, meaning kind of sequential analysis of information. You start out with some change that you notice that's relevant to you, because you only notice changes that are relevant generally. You appraise that change with respect to what you want to happen and what you don't want to happen, your concerns, and how you can cope with it. So if there's somebody in front of you with a knife, then your concern is safety, right? And if they're pushing it towards you, your concern is your own injury or death, and you have to cope by getting out of the way or knocking the knife out of the hand or doing something. Your immediate reaction is kind of being alert and angry and afraid. You don't have to have just one emotion at a time. So your action tendencies I just described. And then you have, you actually carry out the actions your action tendencies, as well as the results of your actions, feedback, creating more notable changes. So you can have emotional reactions to what happens next, or you can have an emotional reaction to your own emotional reaction. The guy has the knife there. You're a macho guy. You're not supposed to be afraid. You feel afraid. That makes you angry. So you have double anger. You're angry because this person is attacking you, and you're angry because you're feeling afraid and you don't want to. So that's the emotion process. Of course, really it's all occurring at the same time. Really it's not so sequential. Sorry. As this diagram makes it look. So in general, most of the people who study emotions think about emotions as occurring in terms of processes like this. It will be helpful for all of us to think about how the dimensions and the emotion families and the emotion scripts relate to this kind of process, so we can unpack it and get a rich understanding of how emotions occur and how process and organization work together. Overview then for what we've tried to discuss today. Emotions are fundamental, broad, general human characteristic, characteristic of mammals in general, where intelligence and emotion evolve together. In human beings, emotions are evidenced in species-specific facial expressions, among many other things. That's the avenue where emotions became a major topic of scientific research in the last 30 years. Emotion and intelligence generally go together. Contrary to our cultural stereotypes, they're not separate. They're two sides of the same coin, like the back of your hand and the palm of your hand, or like the head and the tails on a coin. General emotional approach that's been put together in the last 20 years, radically different from what was there before in many ways, although based on Darwin from long ago, focuses on action tendencies and scripts that define particular emotions, as well as dimensions that organize them, evaluation, activation, and self-other, and families of emotions fitting into kind of prototypic emotion categories. Cultural differences and commonalities in emotion go together, as evidence in all of these different ways of looking at emotional organization. Cultures show the biology of the human species in the emotions that their people express, and they also shape the emotions to fit a certain form that fits the meanings, the scripts, the institutions in the culture.